Bibles, if you will, to the book of 1 Samuel. Book of 1 Samuel. As Wes said, I did announce that this morning, and I don't think it's it has gone unnoticed to anyone that we have quite a few babies that have been born in the last couple of years. It's funny, you know, when you travel around, when I went back home this summer and so forth, you get asked, you know, of course, by people, you know, you get asked, how are things going? You know, how are things going where you're preaching, that kind of thing. And invariably, people will, you know, ask you how many people go, and then they'll start asking questions like, do you have many young people? Do you have many children? And smile will kind of break across my face, and I'm like, yeah, we got a bunch of kids, you know. And then I start talking about the number of babies that have been born, and people are just almost astonished by it. It's like, that is not the norm, of course. For a long time, certainly, there were, when you would talk about churches and when you'd visit different places, you might go somewhere and visit and notice that everybody there was an older person. And someone might start talking about how the congregation was, you know, unfortunately growing older, many members dying, and they weren't sure about the future. But when we think about what we have here, we don't know what the future holds. We don't know what will happen with this congregation. But it is certainly a fact that with all of the young people that we have coming up, the babies that have been born, etc., that there's a great opportunity here. I want to use a story in the Bible of a family and a little boy in particular. We don't often talk of him as a little boy, but we meet him, certainly even before he's born. And that little boy is named Samuel. And, of course, his mother in chapter 1, his mother Hannah. I take it for granted that most everyone here knows the story of Samuel, and I'm not going to read through the bulk of chapter 1. But if you remember, there was a man. His name was Elkanah, or Elkanah, however you want to pronounce that. He was married. He had, verse 2 of chapter 1, two wives. The one wife, Peninnah, she had children. But as the Bible tells you at the end of verse 2, Hannah had no children. Now, as the story unfolds, what we find is that Hannah, and I won't go into all of that kind of comical incident involving Eli and so forth, but Hannah's praying. As I assume that she did often, she is praying and does pray for God to give her children. And I suppose that, you know, most people, doesn't mean everybody, but most young people, young married couples, and then certainly as you get a little bit older and you really want children, if that is the case, and children haven't come, that probably you are in the position of Hannah and you're praying to the Lord and asking certainly God to bless you with children. I've known many people through the years. I've been one of those people, obviously praying to God. And the Bible teaches us an interesting thing both about Hannah, and I think it teaches us elsewhere and invokes a principle. At least I'm going to cite it. So I want to come at this from a particular perspective, if you will. And I'll take you back, if you want to turn back to Genesis 33. You remember the whole story of Jacob and Esau, and I'm not going to spend a lot of time with that. But remember, obviously, Esau sold his birthright. Jacob got the blessing from Isaac. There's, you know, great trouble, and Jacob flees and goes back to the homeland of Abraham, back to where Abraham had first come from. And there he ends up sort of being cheated by his uncle Laban. A lot of people would consider that just desserts. But in the end, he is married to Leah and Rachel, and he has children by both of them and indeed by their two handmaidens. And so he has, as we know, he will end up with 12 sons and a daughter. And when he comes back and meets Esau, and 20 years or so have passed, maybe longer, but he comes back and he meets Esau. And if you're looking at Genesis 33 and look at verses 4 and 5 there, The Bible tells you that they met. You remember, Jacob had a lot of trepidation about that. But when they meet, Esau notices the wives and the children, all of this that Jacob has amassed and brought back into the land of Canaan, and he asks him a question. The Bible says he lifted up his eyes and he saw the women and the children, and he said, and notice the question, "Who are those with thee?" And Jacob answered him and said, "The children which God has graciously given thy servant." It reminds me also of a passage, and I'd like for you to turn with me, and I'm going to tie the two ideas that I really want to bring about tonight in the lesson. I hope it makes sense. But if you'll go with me to Psalm 127. Now, this is a familiar psalm. We quote it or read at least the first part of it often. People have, members of the church do. But let's start in verse 1. It is a very short psalm, and let's look at exactly what it says. "Except the Lord build the house," and we often hear people read that and apply it, and I think you can apply it to the Lord's church. "But except the Lord build the house, they labor in vain that build it. Except the Lord keep the city, the watchman waketh but in vain. It is vain for you to rise up early, to sit up late, to eat the bread of sorrows. For so he giveth his beloved sleep." Now, it almost seems to transition to something that is non sequitur. Notice verse 3. "Lo, children are a heritage," or an inheritance, your translation may say, "of the Lord. And the fruit of the womb is his reward. As arrows are in the hand of a mighty man, so are children of the youth. Happy is the man that has his quiver full of them," speaking of children, obviously. "They shall not be ashamed, but they shall speak with the enemies of the gate." And a lot of times what you'll hear is someone will either read verses 1 through and 2, or they'll read verses 3 through 5, but not often connect the two ideas, but this is one song. So I believe what God is really talking about here is building a family, building a household, almost, if you will, building a name. In other words, a family like the family of Abraham, the greatest that the world has ever known, and God promised that because obviously he blessed all the nations of the world with Abraham and through him and through his seed and all of that. But I think he speaks of each family here and building that family. But he reminds us in the midst of this and all of the excitement and the pride, the family pride and everything that that brings, he reminds us in the midst of this a couple of things. First of all, unless a family is built on the foundation of God, it's a vain labor to build such a family. In other words, you can have, you know, a number of children, you can have many descendants, and they in turn your grandchildren, great-grandchildren, so that the name becomes great and lasts for generation after generation. But if it is not founded upon God, if it's not built upon the principles of God, that family is basically vain. It's vanity. It's not worth what it could be worth, certainly. But it is also true that verse 3, if children have come to someone, then they've come as an inheritance of God. And when we speak of this word inheritance, and I was just looking at the Hebrew word that's used here, I was looking at it earlier, and it's something, it is an inheritance, something that's inherited or entrusted. And the idea here, literally, it comes from a word, you know, we speak of heirlooms, and in fact, one of the words that's used to translate this word is an heirloom. And an heirloom is interesting because an heirloom is something that's, quote unquote, been in the family. It's something that's passed down. We speak of that. It's something that's entrusted for safekeeping. So there might be a piece of jewelry or there might be whatever. It can be almost anything. But it is something that the family holds on to and passes to the next generation and trusts that that next generation will take care of that heirloom, will put forth the effort that it takes to keep it, you know, and pass it on and so forth. Now think about what God is saying here. Your greatest inheritance, your greatest heirloom that's entrusted to you are your children. Now I think we all understand that. If, you know, I can have my house burned down and lose everything within it, and I don't want that to happen. I have things that I like and treasure, quote unquote, and I want to hold on to. And some of those things, they might not be worth as much, you know, very much as far as the world is concerned, but they're heirlooms. Jules is well aware of those things, and I want to pass those things on. And, you know, if she and Marvin have children, we would hope that some of those things would go to them and that kind of thing. But I can lose all of that, and it still would not be my greatest inheritance, my greatest heirloom. What God is saying your greatest inheritance is the children. And I believe Jacob is right when he says to Esau, I mean, who are these? What are these? Well, they're literally the inheritance that God has given me. They're what God has graciously, with great favor, God has given this to me, and He's entrusted it with me. They are my heritage, if you will. Now, let's go back to 1 Samuel 1, because what does that have to do with Hannah? Well, everything. I mean, when you look at 1 Samuel 1, you remember that she's praying. In verse 2, we are introduced to Hannah. We're told she has no children. Drop down with me to verse 10. She was in bitterness of soul. Now, if you've never been in this position, I have. I just lost a friend this past week, and he and his wife, I've known them for literally over 30 years. They work. They didn't have children. And I understand what that feels like. And I also know the great blessing that comes when you've been in that kind of bitterness and had no children. And Jules, I don't want to embarrass you, but I know the great blessing that you feel when a child comes into your life. So when you look at 1 Samuel 1, she was in bitterness of soul, and she prayed unto the Lord. And notice how it says it, and she wept sore or severely. I mean, she's breaking down, crying, and begging God for a child. And notice how in verse 11, she vowed a vow. I know exactly what this feels like. To pray to God and say, you know, if you bring children into our home, bring a child into my life, I'll do everything I can. I'll give it my best. She vowed a vow. And she said, O Lord of hosts, if you will indeed look on the affliction of your handmaid, and remember me, and not forget your handmaid, but you will give unto thine handmaid a man child. Now she's very specific here. You know, I want a son. And if you'll give me a son, she says, now notice the phrase, then I will give him unto the Lord all the days of his life. Now I know that she means literally, and we're going to go on to talk a little bit, not a great amount, but a little bit about exactly what she meant. But I also know that there's a principle there. In praying to God and saying, God, if you'll bless me with a child, I'll do everything I can to give that child back to you. Because we come from God. You know, the Bible clearly tells us when we die, you know, remember that statement in Ecclesiastes, the body returns to the dust of the earth, the soul, the spirit goes back to God who gave it. We come from God. We belong to Him. He gives these children to us as an inheritance. He entrusts us with their safekeeping. And that's what he's saying here. That's what she's praying. If you will give me this child, I'll give him back to you, is the idea. All the days of his life. And then she goes on to probably invoke what is the Nazarite vow here. No razor will come to his head. In other words, he'll be a holy child, and I'll make sure of that. I'll make sure that he's dedicated to you. In other words, she'll do everything she can in her power to do so. A couple of other verses out of chapter 1. Drop down with me to verse 22. Now, we know, of course, she is going to have the child Samuel. But the Bible tells us Hannah went not up, in other words, following Elkanah. She went not up, for she said unto her husband, I will not go up until the child is weaned. So Samuel had been born. He's still nursing, obviously. And then I'll bring him. But notice, I'll bring him for the express purpose that he may appear before the Lord. And then notice this phrase, and there abide forever. I'm going to make a parallel, and I don't think it's a far-fetched one. She has every intention, and she will go through in giving this child to the Lord and to the service of the Lord. She's speaking of the temple. I'm not going up to the temple till I'm ready to bring Samuel, and when I bring Samuel to the temple, I'm going to leave him there forever. And I think the idea, if I were to make the parallel, I think the idea here is that you and I should see ourselves bringing children that God gives us, bringing them to the temple, which today, collectively, our bodies, would be the Lord's church. And it should be the goal that we have that we would bring these children to the Lord, to His church, and that they be there forever. In other words, the sole reason that I should have in my life for everything I do for my child is so that one day I can know that that child is in the kingdom and always going to be there. Always going to be with God. And I think that's exactly what she's saying of Samuel. Notice, if you'll drop down finally at the end of chapter 1, in verse 26. She said, O my Lord, as thy soul lives, my Lord, I am, and she's speaking to the priest Eli, I am the woman that stood by thee here praying unto the Lord. For this child I prayed, speaking of Samuel, I prayed for Samuel. And the Lord has given me my petition, which I ask of him. Now notice verse 28. Therefore also I have lent him to the Lord. And this is the idea of, this word lent in the original language. I've given him. I've given him back is the idea. I've given him back to the Lord. As long as he lives, he shall be given back to the Lord. And he worshiped the Lord there. Isn't that beautiful? When I look at this story, I think of this poor woman, this pitiful woman, without children, in a family where everybody else has children. And if you've never been in that position, if you've never felt that, then you'd understand exactly how terrible that can feel. Everybody else has children, and she has one thing on her mind. She wants a child, but God, if you give me that child, I'll give him back to you. And she means to go through with that, and to her credit, she goes through with that. She's not praying, and vowing this vow in any frivolous way, And we probably have witnessed that. We've probably seen people, who, I want to get married. I want a husband. I want a wife. And God, if you'll do that, then I'll do this and I'll do that, only to realize they don't really intend to do that. They're not going through with it. Same thing with children, etc. But not him. She really meant what she said. Now, I want to focus my attention, if you will, let's focus on Samuel for a little bit. Because we look at this story, and it is a beautiful story of Hannah. It's a beautiful story in looking at it from, from her viewpoint, her perspective. I want this child. This is exactly what I intend to do. She does that. But I look at Samuel, and I think in terms of this little boy. And he is a little boy, obviously, when he's taken, when he's weaned from Hannah, so he's a little boy. He's taken from his home and given into the household and in, of Eli and into the service of the temple. You ever thought about that, really? I mean, you ever thought about what it would be like to be Samuel? And if you are blessed and you're privileged to grow up in a secure home, a secure environment where, you mom and dad, and you've got your home, and that's, when you get home today, wherever you come from, school or whatever it might be, you're going to your same bed. And if you grow up like that, then you won't understand what I'm talking about. But if you grow up in a situation in which you're afraid that all of that can fall apart at any moment, and as far back as you can remember, you don't know that security. You don't know that today you'll have your home that you had yesterday. You get up in the morning and you're not certain, not 100% anyway, that this afternoon or tonight you'll still have a home. If you grow up like that, it can be a terrifying thing. If you've ever been in an environment, in a home situation, and taken from that secure environment, and taken to a completely different home or household to live in, can be a horrible situation. And I'm not trying to look at this and say this was a horrible thing she did, because I don't believe it was, and I don't believe it was that way for Samuel. But I'm just looking at it from the standpoint of being a little boy. And what it would take is an early training. I mean, it would take the kind of thing where this child, from the moment this child can understand anything, he's got to be understanding what his life is all about. The reason he's alive. The reason for living. And that, I think, should be impressed upon children. When we start thinking in terms of teaching children, and I know there are parents here, there are young parents here, and I know you do a fantastic job. I may not know everything about it, but it's obvious you do a fantastic job. But when a child realizes from the moment they're aware, you know, and I mean, I realize children are aware even in the womb, but I'm talking about just start looking around and they have the ability to question and they're being told things. When they're made aware of their one great purpose in life, the world is filled with people who will tell them their purpose is to be themselves, be happy, get what you can get. The world is filled with people who will tell them and teach them the philosophy of putting yourself first. But when we impress upon children, you are here in this world and in this life for one great reason, and that is to serve God and be with Him forever. When a child grows up understanding that from a young age, they've got a tremendous advantage in life. And Samuel had that. So we look at this situation with Samuel and we say, is it an ideal situation? I don't know that it is. Maybe it is. A person might disagree with, and if you do, that's fine. I'm just coming at it from the standpoint of being one of those little boys. Ideal to me is growing up with all of that security, all that foundation, godly parents who teach you that, some of which little children growing up here will have. That's ideal to me, and Samuel didn't have that. But I'll tell you what he did have. When we look at this story, and I want you to spend just a few minutes with me as we go on into chapter 2, we realize Samuel separated from his parents, separated from his mother, and I don't mean totally, I realize, you know, that he still has interaction with them and all that. I'm not forgetting that. But he's put into the house of Eli. He's raised, as it were, in the home of Eli. Now, we might ask the question, you know, we look at Eli and he's the high priest and we say, well, is that a great situation? Without doubt, I think as you look at the story, and you read chapters 2 and 3, without doubt, Samuel benefits from the influence he gets from his parents, especially this godly woman we've been talking about, Hannah. And I believe he benefits from the influence of Eli. But I think we have to realize and we have to remember Eli wasn't a perfect parent. I mean, when we look at Eli and we look at his own sons, we have to at least be willing to admit, regardless of who's to blame. And I want to suggest to you that I think chapter 2 and especially chapter 3 indicates to us Eli was to blame. He's got to at least share in the blame of what happened to his sons. He hasn't been successful with them. So we look at this situation and we think in terms of, okay, what does God allow here? God allows a woman to have a child. It's an answer to prayer, so we have to say that. God gives as an inheritance a child to a woman who has vowed, if you give him to me, I'll give him back to you. And I full well believe God understood what he was saying, what she was saying there. And so God allows this. Just as much as we might say to ourselves, why does God allow children to be born in such and such an environment and all of this kind of thing? Well, here's an example of that. And here's an example of how such a situation can turn out not just good, but really, really good in less than ideal situation, in less than an ideal situation. So Samuel is born. Hannah takes Samuel, places him in the home of Eli, and he begins to grow up in that home. Now, if you read through the rest of chapter 2, it really almost reads like every reason why she should have never let Samuel go to that house. I mean, look at some of the things that it says here. And I don't want to read all of this, but let's just drop down to verse 12. Now, the sons of Eli were sons of Belial, or Belial, a lot of people say. They knew not the Lord. Now, that's interesting, since they're in the priest household, and they are priests themselves, they don't know the Lord. And, you know, you got to step back and say, wow. So you're putting him into a home of a father, at least, that's raised two sons, as we would say today, in the church, and they ain't Christians. So I'm not sure I'd want such a person influencing my child. But let's read on here, because it tells us some of the kinds of things they do. The priest custom with the people was that when any man offered a sacrifice, you can go back and read this, I'm not going to take the time tonight. But when people would offer a sacrifice, well, the priest's servant would come, and while the flesh was in seething, while it's cooking there, with a flesh hook, I don't know, the way I just think of this is like a big fork or whatever, you know, kind of thing that you break apart meat. But with a flesh hook that had three teeth in his hand, he would stick it into the pan or the kettle or the cauldron or the pot. All that the flesh hook brought up. In other words, he'd reach it into the hunk of meat, and whatever it tore away from that hunk of meat, well, that's what the priest would take, and that was their part. In other words, their daily food. And they were allowed to do that. Now notice as it goes on here, it says before verse 15, they burnt the fat, the priest's servant came and said to the man that sacrificed, give flesh to roast for the priest, for he will not have sodden flesh of thee, but raw. Well, now wait a minute, that's not the law. In other words, I want to take my prime cut, you know, I want to take it off the meat before it ever goes into the pot. Well, that's not what God said. But if any man said unto him, verse 16, let them not fail to burn the fat presently, and then take as much as thy soul desires, then he would answer him, no, but you give it to me now, and if not, I'll take it by force. Wow. So here are priests, regardless of what, if we understand all of this law or not, here are priests abusing their office and abusing their privilege God has given them. And these are Eli's sons. And wherefore the sin of the young man, verse 17, was very great before the Lord, for men abhorred or despised, you may have a translation that says, disregarded, total disregard for the offering of the Lord. Isn't that interesting? So I'm looking at that situation and I'm thinking, my child has got to be in this environment. I mean, these are Eli's older sons. And they are without a doubt, I mean, if Samuel's going into that home, he's going to be around such terrible people as this. Now just let that sink in for a moment. And then read the next verse. But, notice verse 18. But Samuel ministered before the Lord, being a child, and girded with a linen ephod. But oftentimes, and I've seen this and no doubt you have as well, you get someone who did less than they should have done with their children. And as I said, we'll read a passage that will clearly show us Eli is at least partly to blame in this. And what happens is, you know, they can do one of two things. They can do like a lot of people do. Children grow up, they do wrong. Parents rush in there and reinforce that, help to enable that, become part of that. And sometimes even with pride, stand up in defense of the sin they're committing. They can do that. Doesn't help anybody. Doesn't help the children, doesn't help themselves, doesn't help other people around them. Well, the parent can learn from that. They can clearly say to their kids, even if they've been partly to blame, they can clearly say to their kids, what you're doing is not right. And while the child might look at them and say, well, you know, you did this or you did that, and that would be fair, it still isn't right what they're doing. And sometimes, and this is a great opportunity for someone, and no doubt we've seen people that fall into this category, sometimes that individual becomes a good influence on those children who come later. And I believe that's the opportunity that we have in this life. If we've made a mistake before, we can either be proud and step up in defense of it and blame everybody else in the world or whatever, or we can acknowledge it and then be a strong influence on those who are coming later. Don't make those mistakes. I'll be honest with you, I make them. I'll be honest with you what I suffer because of that. Don't make those same mistakes. We all have that opportunity. We all have the opportunity to provide that kind of influence. That, and I don't know if that's what Eli did. Don't misunderstand. The Bible's not saying, here's how Eli excelled with Samuel. I'm just saying that in this environment, he failed with these two sons. What are the names? Hophni and Phinehas, I believe, something like that. But he failed with these two sons. But Samuel grows up in this house, and that's not how he turns out. So something had to be going on there. Samuel is spiritual. And we look at this in chapter 2 and what stands out to us again and again and again in this passage. It'll use this phrase, but Samuel, moreover Samuel, and yet Samuel. And it'll tell you how Samuel is just the opposite throughout this passage. Now, let me step away for a moment and say this. Ultimately, everything depends on the individual's choice. When I look at Samuel and I look at Samuel doing well and all of this kind of thing, ultimately, no matter the environment you grow up in, no matter the house you grow up in, no matter what is said to you, whether it's encouraging or discouraging, and I've shared a lot of things from the pulpit with you. I had things that were encouraging to me. I had people like my grandmother, you know. My parents would say very encouraging things, but I had people that were very discouraging to me. And every time I'd make a mistake, oh, see, we always knew that's how you would do. We knew that's how you would turn out, you know, et cetera, et cetera. So we all understand that. You have positive, you have negative. Ultimately, it's your choice. And what I had to realize and what you had to realize and what all these children, these babies that have just been born, if time goes on, they will have to realize someday. They will have to realize that regardless of if they had the best of influences, the best of environment, the best home, etc., and situation to grow up in, or they had the worst, they have to make the choice. And God leaves to each of us to make the choice. And I believe that God providentially provides a choice for us. In other words, it's not a set pattern. If someone looked at me as a child, and people did, you don't have a chance. Well, why? Why do I not have a chance? You'll never amount to anything. Why? You know, if someone looks at me and says, you know, you are this and your parents were that and so forth and you're just going to be just like them. Why? And at some point, I have a choice, you have a choice, these children will have a choice. Which brings me to what? How do you tie all of this together? It's very simple. If this house, as we were talking about this morning, if this church has a dedicated membership of people identifying with God, even a child growing up in the worst of circumstances has the opportunity to be able to look around and see people who do differently. And if you are the only person in your family who says, no, I won't follow down that same path. If you are the Samuel that looks around and says, I won't go that way. I mean, think about what chapter 2 is saying. Eli's sons are terrible. And it hasn't even told you what I consider to be the most despicable things they do. Not yet. But even if Samuel is able to look around and see that, and maybe he looks at Eli, and Eli, this big old fat guy, you know, that blew it with his sons, maybe he's saying different things to Samuel. Maybe he's not. I don't know. But if he's able to look at all of that, or even able to look at his mom and dad and say, I wish I was back home, you know, he still has the choice to choose God. And when he begins to see the difference that choosing God can mean, and you don't necessarily see it quickly, do you? Sometimes you make the choice to follow God,
And everybody around you is not happy. Family's not happy. Friends are not happy. People don't believe in you. And the best of people sort of waiting back to see, well, how will you turn out? But over time you begin to see. And those children have that opportunity if we as a membership, if we as a fellowship, if we as a church make that decision to provide those good examples and reinforce, hopefully, reinforce the good environment they've got at home, that makes a huge difference. And they will have that opportunity to see all of that. Let's go on and talk for a moment about what was going on in Samuel's day. And I don't know that it was altogether unlike what's going on in our day. Because it echoes, to me, this passage echoes a real problem that we see today. You know, we hear in prayers, I pray, you know, about what's going on in the country. You got to be living under a rock not to realize that things are not what we wish they were in this country. You know, as was prayed this morning, you know, this nation is a strong nation still. Extremely influential nation. Many would consider it to be the most influential in the world. And whether that's true or it's not true, I don't know, but it certainly is right up there. And yeah, we've got a lot of problems. But at the same time, as a Christian, I can't step back and begin to say, as so many people are willing to say, you know, what's going on in our world? Look around it. Talk about all the bad things that are going on in the world. Talk about all the failures of all the leaders. Talk about how violence is rampant in this nation. And it is. You know, public gatherings have turned into rock throwing, urine throwing, and everything else. You know, we can talk about all of that. And we can say, as I remember, as a child, sometimes things being said to me, you have no hope. Well, that's a great thing to say to a kid, isn't it? You have no hope. Well, why not? You know? Why can't I make certain choices, work hard, etc.? Why can't I have what everybody else has? Why not? But no, to look at everything going on around you and say, man, these kids have no hope. Well, imagine being a little kid listening to all that. You're looking on the television, you're seeing all the garbage that's on the TV, and the people that you count on and look to be the greatest influence in your life are saying to you, you ain't got no hope. That's a wonderful influence, isn't it? But no, if their parents are raising them and teaching them and talking about people who rose above all of these kinds of things in as bad a situation, even worse. And then they are allowed to go to church and brought to church and they're raised with people and they see these same people. These faces that they learn as little kids. They learn your name. They learn who you are. And as they get older, they know you. They expect you to be there. They count on you to be there. And maybe all it is just a passing influence. Listen, I look back on people in my childhood and I can name them for you right now. Sunday school teachers. People that gave us a ride sometimes to church. Things they said to us. And man, what a relief it was. And what a difference it was. And to have these people who were good people. And who were saying just the opposite. Saying things sometimes like, you know, you can do anything you want to do. You can be anything you want to be. You can have every blessing and opportunity. Sometimes speaking about God and telling what a wonderful God He was and all of that. You hear all of that and maybe it's just in passing. But boy, does it stick with you. And when you're a child and you're grabbing on to anything you can grab on to because someone is referring to you in the vilest of terms, and I'm talking about close family members that should not have been. Then you grab those things and you hold those things. We have problems in this country. We have problems in the church. We have problems because we're human beings. But to realize and acknowledge the opportunity we have to be a positive influence on these children. To let these children see people that believe in these things. When so many are telling you, this is a book of myths and fairy tales. It doesn't mean anything. This isn't real. Well, I know this good person at church and they sure believe it. Michael's a little bit crazy, but he sure acts like he believes it, you know. It makes a difference. That's the point. Sometimes those of us are older. We look back on the times, on the way things were. And I can be guilty of this. I'm old enough now to be guilty of it. And I can talk about the way things were when I was a kid. And somehow over the course of time, you know, everything gets wonderful. The older you get, well, the way it was wonderful, right? And you forget about all the problems that we had back then. And you forget about the things that were going on then that disturbed people as much as the things going on around us today disturb us. And yet I still remember those people. And I remember how important it was. And some of the things that I treasured as a childhood, you know, as a child, in my childhood. You think about passages in the Bible like train up a child in the way it should go. I can remember crawling up on the couch with a parent, or a grandmother, and being told stories out of the Bible, and they fascinated me. And I can remember hearing about good people. Even people, you know, that they knew who had died, and I didn't really understand all of that, but good people that they had known, older people when they were a child like me. And all that stuff sticks with you. And so then when someone comes along and they say one of those really negative things, all the difference that it makes. So we look at Samuel. And we realize we have a great opportunity here in this church. And we have a great opportunity with just the people that are here to make a difference. And no, you may not be the parent in the home. If you are, then you have an awesome responsibility and you also have the greatest of opportunity. But all of us here, all of us are being blessed in this church with these children. I don't know how you feel, but you know, when Melissa or Beth or even Wes, you know, but when they're giving birth to these children, when they're having these children in their home, come into their homes. He's not going to give birth, incidentally, but I caught that. I knew when I said it. But no, but the children will be coming into his home. They have the greatest of opportunity, but we all do. We all have the opportunity to put on the best behavior, to be the best kind of people, to realize the difference it can make, the positive reinforcement there is in numbers, and to allow these children to grow up in an environment of a group of people. If everybody out there is hating and fighting each other and all of that kind of thing, we can't stop that. But we can show them something different here. To let them see a group of people who really believe in the Word of God, that really believe in the Lord. To let them see people who honor Him, and who, like was read in the passage that Marvin read for us from 1 Peter 2, take seriously their responsibility, like Samuel did, of being a priest, of growing up in the home of Eli. And instead of all the things that they were doing, you know, when you get into chapter 3, and I talked about how the most despicable things and so forth, and you began to read that at the opening of chapter 3, you know, and you realize that here were priests. They weren't just abusing their privilege of grabbing the meat and all of that kind of thing, or even threatening to take it by force. They were actually, women served at the temple, they were actually committing fornication. You know the devastating effect that has on a child to be part of a congregation where two people in the congregation commit fornication? It's devastating. And here is a world filled, I mean, think of the glorification of fornication going on in this country and the world. There's a whole different set of values, a whole different set of morals that surround fornication. Fornication is perfectly fine as long as we follow this new set of rules and values about it. And then to fail children so that they see such an example. That's what I'm talking about here. When Samuel grew up, he saw, and he could see. Here were people doing this kind of thing. He grew up in that environment, and yet he, and we look at his mother, we look at these people, they're not going to follow suit with that. I'm not going to follow in those steps. We can be that great example. We can be that positive reinforcement. We can be the people who take seriously our calling to be holy, just like the passage says there, to live differently than the world around us, to show them something differently. I think Samuel had a great advantage. Maybe the greatest advantage he had was being born to a mother who honored her commitment to God. Maybe there is nothing greater than that. I don't know. Maybe he had the advantage, and I don't know again, of a growing up in a home of a man who had made mistakes. But perhaps as we see him, at least we see him in chapter 3, you know, in this funny or comical incident that occurs here when God is coming to Samuel as a boy, remember, as a child, and Samuel thinks it's Eli calling him, and he runs in there, and finally Eli, he wakes him up the third time, says, no, go back, and the next time, that's God calling you. Listen to God. You know, it's funny, but doesn't it illustrate something to us? I mean, regardless of what you've done, regardless of the mistakes you've made, and he'd made them, you still can be the kind of person that says to a child, above everything else, listen to God. You want to be fine in this life, you want to do well in this life, listen to God. Wish I had listened to God. I wish I'd never made a mistake. I'd always listened to God. I wouldn't pay for what I've done. But you can listen to God. Listen to what God says. If we don't say anything else to these children, I don't think we could say anything more valuable. Now, this lesson, I don't know if it's made sense or not. I hope it has. Be a good influence. Be the kind of people that offer something positive to these kids. If you're here tonight and you're not a Christian, if you believe in Jesus, that He's the Son of God, then you'll confess that. If tonight you're willing to repent, to change your life, to be baptized for forgiveness of your sins, the Lord will forgive you. The Lord will bless you. And when the Lord blesses you with whatever He gives you in this life, take it responsibly and use it for Him. If you need to come, please come while we stand.